you're a pilot and you understand your own body and you say, I am too fatigued to fly, you can say, I can't fly. Don't.
A proposed FAA rule aimed at preventing crashes caused by pilot fatigue. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 10th of September. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Alaska's volcanologists enjoy a lull in eruption activity.
We've enjoyed it. We've considered this sort of a respite. This gives us a chance to do a better job being ready for the next one.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Housing Administration's network of FHA-approved housing counseling agencies offers free expert advice to homeowners whose mortgages are at risk, underwater, or in need of refinancing. Visit hud.gov/Alaska for a counselor near you. This message sponsored by HUD.
Regulations now require commercial airplane pilots to get 8 hours of rest out of every 24, but the 8-hour rest time starts as soon as the pilot walks off the plane. He or she may spend a few more hours at work, although not flying, and commute even by air to and from a duty station, and end up getting only little sleep. Some spend days on that kind of a schedule. Today, the Federal Department of Transportation announced proposed rules meant to boost safety. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Some safety experts and pilot associations believe pilot fatigue may be linked to 1/5 of all airplane crashes. Here's one dramatic and tragic example. In February 2009, both the pilots of Colgan Flight 3047 spent all night and all day either traveling to or at the Newark, New Jersey airport before their 9:18 p.m. departure for Buffalo, New York. When the plane stalled, the pilot didn't make the quick, correct moves needed to handle the situation. The plane crashed into a house, killing all 49 people on board and one on the ground. FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt says the families of those who died brought a sense of urgency to the matter.
Every story is a sad story when you lose a loved one, particularly in a crash like this, where you see the results of the NTSB report and you see what happened. It could have been prevented.
After the Coghlan 3047 crash, Congress directed the Federal Aviation Administration to change regulations governing pilot duty. U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood has announced a proposed rule that lays out changes and makes them a joint responsibility.
Number one, we've acknowledged that commuting in and of itself is not part of rest. Number two, we put some responsibility on the pilot. And number three, responsibility on the corporation to understand when commuting is taking place. And finally, we've asked the industry for comments. This is a very complicated area for us to understand, and we've asked very openly for comments as to what else could we do.
The new rule would increase the opportunity for rest by 1 hour to 9 hours per day and reduce the maximum number of hours at a duty station from 16 to 13 hours. LaHood says the proposed rule takes into account emerging scientific information about the effect of our biological clocks or circadian rhythms, time zones, and chronic fatigue on decision-making and alertness.
It curtails the length of a pilot's duty period now based upon the time of day the pilot actually reports to go into duty. Big difference between going to work at 8 o'clock in the morning and going to work at 11 o'clock at night. It factors in time zones. It factors in, is the pilot going to be able to get the required sleep?
The new rule would also allow pilots to decline duty if they knew they had not had enough rest.
If you're a pilot and you understand your own body and you say, I am too fatigued to fly, you can say, I can't fly. Don't. And you can do that without penalty. And that's a big step. That's something we don't have today.
Several air carriers and pilots associations said they are not able to comment on the proposed rule yet. Spokesperson Bobby Egan of Alaska Airlines said most of Alaska's airlines' existing policies for duty time fall below the proposed FAA duty limits and have been in place since about the 1990s, but the company is carefully reviewing the 145-page proposal to see what kind of impact it might have on its operations, if any. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
A small cruise line known for its intimate Alaska sailings is in trouble. Seattle-based Cruise West is reorganizing and has laid off staff and stopped booking reservations. That's left some cruises, which include Alaska, Europe, and Central America routes, in doubt. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld takes a look at the company's role in Southeast's tourism industry and what the changes could mean for port communities.
Cruise West has operated for more than three decades, carving out a niche market with small ships offering close-up tours.
They played a huge role in Southeast. They've been a long-term player bringing people to Alaska.
Fred Reeder is a former mayor of Sitka who serves as local port manager for Cruise Line Agencies of Alaska. He hopes Cruise West is able to continue its Alaska sailings, and he says a shutdown would impact the region.
Nobody knows whether they're coming back or what their reorganization means, so it will be interesting to see, but they were a long-time company and well-respected in Alaska.
What set them apart, of course, is because they're a small ship, they were able to go to communities that aren't normally on the large ship itineraries.
Lorraine Palmer is executive director of Juneau's Convention and Visitors Bureau. The capital city recently became Cruise West's main southeast port. This year, its four regional ships began and ended sailings there. Palmer says that meant passengers tended to spend more money.
You know, it's really wonderful to have people spend the night in town, have the opportunity to do a pre or post cruise experience here in Juneau. So that's played a really nice niche that isn't currently served. Our large ships, of course, just come in for port calls during the day.
Cruise West used to sail up the Inside Passage, stopping at a number of large and small communities. A new routing system dropped Ketchikan and reduced time at some other destinations, but it maintained stops in Sitka, Haines, Skagway, Petersburg, Wrangell, and Metlakatla. And for the smaller towns, the company made up a significant part, if not the majority, of the visits. Cruise West ships just finished up their summer season in Southeast, and they averaged about 100 passengers each, far fewer than the big ships, which can carry several thousand tourists and crew members. But Sandy Lorigan of Sitka's Convention and Visitors Bureau says small ship visitors often spend more money and are more interested in local culture and history than large ship tourists.
Small ships like these all add up over the summer, and, you know, when many of them come in once or twice a week, it's still spending dollars to our community. And I feel like with their passengers and as well as their crew, they've also been part of our community for a long time since they have been coming here. And it's kind of like an institution, just like the larger cruise ship lines are.
Cruise West is not taking reporters' calls or answering direct questions about its status. A recording on its main phone line denied reports that it had been sold, and a note on its website said it would continue some Northwest sailings based in Seattle and Portland. But that note also stated it was ending an around-the-world cruise and selling off some assets. It also advised passengers how to get refunds for unused tickets. Meanwhile, Washington employment officials said the company told it it's laying off 65 employees. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the bumpy road to Alaska's first farmed gooey duck clams.
Well, I killed tens of thousands of them. I know for sure because I dumped one tray one time and 30,000 in them and killed them all.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
increase community policing and cut down on the time officers spend handling calls for service. Those were just two of the recommendations released yesterday in a staffing and deployment study of the Anchorage Police Department. KSKA's Len Anderson has the details.
At the end of the City Hall press conference, Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew offered a final assessment of his reaction to the just-released deployment study.
He's put some things in perspective for me, and I think we'll put that to good use.
He is Dr. Craig Fraser of the Police Executive Research Forum, a private, nonprofit research firm based in Washington, D.C. Fraser and the Forum have conducted well over 100 studies on police departments and procedures. Fraser says the research company does not use officer-to-population ratios.
Two key workload measures that we start with is looking at patrol, because that's the bulk of the force, and that's officers responding to calls for service, and investigations, that is looking at the investigation of crimes that are reported to an agency.
Overall, Fraser rates the Anchorage Police Department performance as good and describes the proposed changes as incremental, both in scope and timing, the latter dependent to a considerable degree on the status of the municipal budget. Some of those proposed changes include
creating a system of officers owning beats so that they know what's going on in a particular beat. They work that beat over time. They don't get calls outside that beat unless absolutely necessary. Creating over time a north-south division so that there's more geographical accountability and responsibility. The department needs to have a ComStat meeting where there is information or there are discussions about the kinds of things that are going on in the city. So it's not just about crime, but it's also about neighborhood issues.
Neighborhood issues-based police work translates as community policing, a proactive approach integrating officers into their beat areas. It involves seeking out community residents, businesses, and meetings. Much of it comes from something called unobligated time. Before the study, Chief Mew says the department was trying to increase unobligated time to 40% of a patrol officer's weekly shift. Fraser did not recommend 40%.
That 40% is very generous. We have seen very few departments that can get to that 40% unobligated time figure. Much more typically, you'll see departments get at about 30%.
Chief Mew and Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan appear to agree with Fraser's assessment. However, in an afternoon press conference, Sergeant Derek Scher, president of the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association, disagreed.
If a guy has 50% unobligated patrol time, there might be an opportunity for 1 or 2 hour blocks to actually go out to a citizens meeting or something like that. When you start to break the officer's time down even smaller than that, the officer may have the unobligated patrol time, but it doesn't occur in large enough blocks to actually get something done.
Scher cited the International Association of Chief of Police studies that say a patrol officer's unobligated time should be 60% of their duty for effective community policing. The just-released report discusses three staff situations. First, it seeks to show how the current police department staff levels could be used for maximum efficiency. It also offers a guide as to how, when the city's budget grows fatter and the department's funding larger, staff increases could have the best effect. However, should the upcoming year's fiscal gap require cutbacks, the study also has recommendations for staff reductions. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, or CIRCAC, has removed one of its most outspoken critics from the board of directors. Bob Shavelson, who also heads the Homer-based environmental organization Cook Inlet Keeper, was kicked off the CIRCAC board last week. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has more.
Bob Shavelson had served on the CIRCAC board for 6 years, rising to the level of vice president and earning the organization's Volunteer of the Year award. But during a behind-closed-doors meeting last Wednesday, the board decided to expel him.
Essentially what happened was the board had a special meeting. They held the meeting in executive session. At the end of this session, when they came out of session, Bob Shavelson had been removed for cause. But other than that, that's about all they're saying.
That's CERCAC spokesperson Trenton Dodson, who declined to provide specifics on why Shavelson was removed from the board. However, in a letter obtained by KBBI News dated September 2nd, CERCAC board president Grace Merkus said Shavelson was being removed from the board for, quote, violation of his duty of loyalty and violation of Cook Inlet RCAC policies. Shavelson, says Merkus in the letter, was guilty of attempting to publicly discredit the organization and, quote, harassing staff and falsely accusing them of improper behavior. Shavelson says he did not harass anyone, but admits to being a, quote, burr under the saddle for his fellow board members by speaking out against certain policies and actions taken by the organization.
They're pointing largely to a letter that I released in June in response to a report that CERCAC commissioned involving the Drift River oil terminal incident and the eruption of the Mount Redoubt volcano and the oil that was left by Chevron at the base of that erupting volcano, along with the CERCAC meeting that they had in Anchorage in June and some of the comments that I made there.
Shavelson says he tried to work within the system at CERCAC.
But over time, I saw a pattern of collusion with the oil industry and complacency that I felt I had a moral obligation to speak out. And I would do it again because it was the right thing. And I think it's necessary for the citizens of Cook Inlet to have an independent voice. I think that's what CERCAC was supposed to be. But I think the organization is badly broken and needs to be reevaluated.
CERCAC, which was created as part of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, has an inherent conflict of interest in its very setup, Shavelson claims. Unlike its counterpart in Prince William Sound, the Prince William Sound RCAC, CERCAC relies on the oil industry for its funding and must negotiate with the producers every 2 years to set its budget. The arrangement, says Shavelson, prevents CERCAC from being an effective watchdog over oil industry operations in the inlet. Shavelson says he won't fight the board's decision, but he is disappointed that he was unable to change the organization from the inside.
I put in 6 long years, and I really tried, and there's some good people with the organization, but it's kind of fascinating in a scary way to see the tentacles of the oil industry and to see how the influence of the oil industry shapes conversations and decisions and how cover-ups occur.
Shavelson says Cook Inlet Keeper, the Homer-based nonprofit environmental organization for which he is executive director, was created in 1995 in part because of a perceived conflict of interest between CERCAC and the oil industry. He says his removal from the CERCAC board will give him more time to focus on his day job at Cook Inlet Keeper. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
The Cold Climate Housing Research Center is expanding its facility to make room for more interaction with outside agencies and the public. The center, located at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, has received federal and private grants totaling $2 million to build a 7,500-square-foot addition. CCHRC President and CEO Jack Hebert says the new Sustainable Northern Community Center will bring collaborators in-house.
Numerous state and federal agencies and perhaps a representative from the Alaska Housing Authorities working there with CCHRC and others to get some things done.
Hebert says the new center wing will also include classroom space. The facility will be an addition to the 15,000-square-foot main cold climate housing center building completed in 2007. It was recently named as one of the 4 smartest buildings in the country by Siemens Corporation. Siemens and other technology companies have outfitted the center with 1,200 sensors that monitors systems from the foundation to the rooftop to track performance, including energy efficiency. The nonprofit Cold Climate Housing Research Center, started by the Alaska Home Builders Association, works to find and develop housing technology to suit challenges around Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help.
The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
A Texas railroad executive has been selected to run the Alaska Railroad Corporation. Christopher Adneson is scheduled to begin his new post as president and CEO later this month. He was selected unanimously by the railroad's 7-member board of directors. Railroad officials say Adneson brings nearly 4 decades of experience in the railroad industry. With his most recent position as CEO of Estonian Railways, he replaces interim railroad president Bill O'Leary. The first Alaska-farmed gooey duck clams were recently delivered to market. KRBD's Deanna Garrison spoke with the responsible Ketchikan farmer about the major milestone in the fledgling industry.
These tanks have 5 inches of sand in them, and the water just comes in, flows across, and goes back to the bay. And it's a constant flow. It's about 2,000 gallons an hour, and we can put about 10,000 babies in here.
Alaska Shellfish co-owner Kurt Morin is standing in a makeshift floating gooey duck nursery just outside of Ward Cove. This is a place that Morin and other gooey duck farmers carefully raise their clams from 3-millimeter seed to a plantable size of around 27 millimeters. Then the farmers take their tiny clams and plant them on farm sites leased from the state of Alaska. It takes another 5 years to grow the gooey duck to a harvestable size. Morin's company has 4 different farm sites totaling around 30 acres in the Ketchikan vicinity. The state currently leases 25 farm sites in southeast Alaska. Morin was the first person to push for gooey duck farming in Alaska. Fittingly, his company was the first to begin harvesting and selling farm-raised Alaska gooey ducks.
I started the whole thing in an attempt to expand our commercial fishery. We were only getting 3 or 5 days a year of diving for gooey ducks, and the thought was to find a way that we could get more days of fishing. And it evolved into, well, if we plant our own beaches, we can manage them ourselves. We wouldn't have to, you know, wait for fishing game, who at the time didn't have the resources and the manpower to expand the fishery. So that's where the whole idea came, was to increase the number of fishing days for the fishermen. And it kind of evolved into this farming idea.
After the idea began percolating, Morin says a number of commercial divers became interested in gooey duck farming.
There was a good 20 people interested in doing gooey duck farming, but most of the people didn't stick with it when they found out how difficult the regulations and leases and permits and all that process was, and how expensive it was. Most people dropped out.
Knowing what he knows now, Morin says he isn't sure if he would again lead the effort to get the industry off the ground. For one, he says it took a lot of his time, 12 years in fact. Then there was the approximately $500,000 investment that he and his investors wouldn't begin to see a return on until late last month.
It took longer than I thought. It was harder than I thought, and it was certainly a lot more expensive than I thought it was going to be, but it's great to be at a point where we can say, yes, we can do this. We can take adult clams, spawn them, raise that seed up to a plantable size, put it out on the farms, and expect it to, you know, grow into a product we can sell.
Warren says finding a reliable source of hatchery-produced seed is the single largest issue facing the industry today. If that doesn't happen, he says the industry will likely die. Alaska gooey duck farmers can't import their seed, and only one Alaska hatchery is providing farmers with seed. He says he didn't get any seed from the hatchery last year and only about 1,500 seed this year. Morin and other area farmers are working with the Ketchikan Gateway Borough to open a second mariculture hatchery in Ketchikan to provide the seed needed to keep the industry in operation and provide for potential growth. Although significant, the seed issue is just one stumbling block the industry has suffered over the years. Morin says his successful harvest came with a fair share of his own personal mistakes.
Well, I killed tens of thousands of them. I know for sure because I dumped one tray one time and had 30,000 in them and killed them all. And I took a shipment, I don't know, I think it was some 20, 25,000 of them down to plant, and we suffocated them. We drowned them.
Warren expects to harvest more mature geitek from his farm this week. He and other farmers hope this is the beginning of a lucrative industry. There's good reason for that optimism. Warren estimates that it costs his company around 50 cents to purchase the seed and grow each geitek to a harvestable size. The company nets between $8 and $12 a pound for those same farm-raised clams. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Observers of the volcanoes in Alaska likely have noticed a lack of significant volcanic activity in recent months after years of high activity. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Other than the recent color code increase of the Cleveland volcano in the Aleutians, things have been rather quiet in recent months for the Alaska Volcano Observatory, which is tasked with monitoring the over 130 volcanoes in Alaska. Steve McNutt is a seismologist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory. He was recently in Dillingham working on a project to install a new acoustic sensing array and observed that Alaska can at times have down periods of volcanic activity.
Alaska has two or three volcanoes active per year. But we've had a funny quiet zone from 2000, from about 2001 until 2005 for a period of over 4 years. It was very quiet. We had no eruptions at all. Then we got Augustine in 2006, four peaked in 2006, then Pavlov 2007, an eruption that lasted over a month. And then the triple whammy in 2008, we had Akmak go off in July, and then Cleveland 2 or 3 weeks later, and then Casatochi in August. And Casatochi put out the largest SO2 cloud worldwide in over 20 years. We're not sure why they come bunched like that. It could just be a statistical fluctuation, which is most likely. In other words, there doesn't have to be a physical reason for that.
The volcanoes in Alaska make up over 3/4 of the volcanoes in the United States, and the series of eruptions from Mount Redoubt between 1989 and 1990 were the second most costly in the history of the United States. Since 1760, there have been 230 confirmed eruptions from 27 volcanoes in Alaska. Steve McNutt says the down period in recent months after the eruptions in 2008 have allowed the staff at the Alaska Volcano Observatory to get stuff done.
We've enjoyed it. We've considered this sort of a respite. This gives us a chance to study some of the older data and to actually understand what's going on and also do a better job being ready for the next one. When you're in constant crisis mode, it's exciting, but you're not actually doing the science at that time. You're just trying to make sure that you're recording the data and able to say something in the future.
At present, the only volcano in Alaska with elevated activity is the Cleveland volcano in the Aleutian Islands. On August 26th, AVO increased the volcano alert level for Cleveland from unassigned to advisory. That was because satellite images showed a persistent thermal anomaly at the volcano's summit. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka, Lynn Anderson and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message is sponsored by the FAA.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.